Welcome to Planning for Retirement with Scott Nelson. Plan well, retire happy.
Well, welcome everyone to another episode of Planning for Retirement. Today, our special guest is Zenick Bishop of Bishop Estate Law. He's one of my favorite estate planning attorneys and resident expert on all things estate law. We also have my daughter, Elise Azaris, our soon-to-be full-blown advisor. Just one more exam to go. No pressure. So, welcome. How are you, Zenick?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Super. So, part of my mission as founder and father here is to get Elise trained up. And we specialize, as you know, in planning for retirement. Typically, when we see people coming in and they're planning for their retirement and everything, they're wanting to get everything planned, including their estate, make sure everything goes the way they'd like it to. So we get all kinds of estate planning questions all the time. And as you know, we send many your way. Elise has a list of things because she's not always in on those interviews. And I thought that would be a fresh perspective.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought we would start with some basics. So what are the key elements of a comprehensive estate plan?
With estate planning, generally the idea behind it is that you just want to make sure that everything you have has a place to go and it's where you want it to go. And so, for example, with investments with you, there's a lot of beneficiary designations and that works great. From there, it's really just getting the documents to get your stuff where you want it to go. Generally, that includes a trust or a will, and then powers of attorney and medical directives. I also do personal items directives because one of my focuses that I try and focus on is to prevent fighting and to prevent litigation, because that's about half of my practice is litigation and people fighting over their parents' stuff, and it's just awful, and I try and prevent it as much as possible. So the main elements is generally that, just, and the idea is just to get your stuff from one spot to where it wants to go.
Perfect.
So in starting a trust or a will, what are some things that clients would need in order to get that going with you?
So you just need to know what assets you have and where you want it to go. And so in starting a trust, if you, for example, I always tell clients, if you have a home, it makes sense to have a trust, because if not, it'll have to go through probate. You might as well put it in a trust and avoid probate. And so you just need to know what you have. You need to have a plan of where you want it to go and what and how you want things divided and distributed. And then we just sit down and kind of map it out and get it to go where it needs to go.
How long does it typically take to set up a trust?
Generally, unless you have something really unique, my process is about 2.5 weeks. And so clients will come in, I'll sit down with them for about an hour, go through everything. And then they'll come back in a couple weeks and we review it, make sure it's what they want, and then we sign it. And so unless there's something unique or weird, it's usually about 2 to 3 weeks.
That's not bad.
Now, for the uninitiated, why would someone want to avoid probate?
So probate, it's an extra cost. Probate has a really bad stigmatism to it, that it's a terrible thing. It can be a terrible thing. But generally, in my opinion, it's just an extra hoop you don't need to go through. There's a couple reasons why you'd really want to avoid it. First off, it's public. What probate is just basically going through the court to get someone appointed to act on behalf of the person that's passed away. And so it's public information that generally people can access. It's an extra thing. And it gives the worst thing for me is that it just gives people an extra forum to fight, because with probate, you have to notify all the interested parties. And if someone disagrees, that's where it begins. And so it's expensive. It's unnecessary if you set everything up right, and people can fight, and they do often.
And being public, I have heard stories, and I don't know how true they are, but I have heard stories of people coming and making claims against the estate. Hey, I fixed his roof. He didn't pay me. That kind of thing. Is that?
That happens all the time. I mean, that what probate does is it basically notifies people that someone's passed away. And so if you have a claim, you can make it. That does create a situation where you can fight over it. Utah actually changed the law where they limited how long people can come back to make claims against the estate. And so there's different things you can do if there's debts that the estate may have. You can, first off, you can send a letter to someone and say, I think there's a claim here, and that limits the time. You can publish notice in the paper 3 consecutive weeks, and that limits the time. Or if you don't do anything, you have a year, and then after a year, every claim's barred. People can't come back after a year, 2 years, and say, I did this and I need money. At that point, they want finality.
But that said, that means this thing's going to drag out for a year, potentially, if we're having to go to probate.
Yeah, unless you do those other steps that will limit it a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, if you go through probate, there's a claim that can be made within a year.
Do you help clients set up a power of attorney or personal representative? I'm not sure which one it's called, but if somebody becomes incapacitated, how do you help them decide that process?
Of what to do. When people come in, the thing with incapacity, it's kind of weird because a lot of times people will come in and they'll not necessarily want to spend as much money. So they'll say, you know, I need a trust. And so I want to do that, but I don't necessarily want to do the power of attorney. And I tell people, you don't necessarily need a power of attorney. I mean, a power of attorney is, a lot of people have powers of attorney and then they pass away and it never becomes effective because they die before they become incapacitated. But the downside of not having, I tell them it's a roll of the dice. You don't necessarily have to have one. If you don't have one and you need one, at that point you can't, if you're incapacitated, you can't create one. And so you have to go to court and you have to get a guardianship, which is not fun. It takes a lot of time and it's way more expensive. And so generally I'll tell clients it's a good thing to have. It's good to have in place. That can get expensive. I mean, I've had guardianship cases that have been going. I have one right now that I'm dealing with that's been going on for 2 years. That if there was a decent power of attorney, it never would have happened at all. Wow. In my opinion, I mean, you can save a buck here or there. You may end up paying 100 times that later.
Yeah.
For sure.
Do you have any stories of clients that we've dealt with that have needed
help? Yeah, in fact, we had a client we referred to Zenik. This was one of those sad COVID stories, and there's several. But in one particular case, we had a client, and you know, with couples, typically, there is one member of the marriage that handles all the bills and the money and just deals with it. And the other one's there and they're in the loop, but not directly involved. And with this particular couple, that was the case. He handled all of everything. He actually had a couple of accounts. They'd moved their bank and she hadn't gone in to sign the signature card. She wasn't listed on the account. It was all his. And they both contracted COVID. He got it worse. He was hospitalized. She couldn't get in to see him. He sat down on the edge of his bed the first night there and went through and paid all of next month's bills on his phone and then slipped into a coma from which he never recovered. But he was in that coma for 6 weeks. She wasn't on the bank account. She wasn't on the bills. No one would tell her what was owed. She started getting late notices in the mail because he had everything online. And so she had to go and sue for guardianship to have authority to manage their own things. So it happens. And Zenik and I have talked about this a lot offline, but most of the hanky-panky and shenanigans that take place in an estate don't happen after the death of the individual. They happen before, during the period of incapacity. So having a power of attorney established and rules and instructions ahead of time makes all the difference in the world.
Right. Well, and having a good power of attorney, because a lot of times people have like a one pager that just basically says you can do whatever you want. I make sure I put in there that there needs to be some kind of accounting provision. So because that's the situation where it's hard to determine what was used for what when someone's managing money for someone else. Mm-hmm. And so they can go to Walmart, spend $500, and there's no way to say, you know, that was for mom and dad or not. And so I put in accounting provisions to make sure that if someone's managing money, the other beneficiaries, the other interested parties have a way to just check on it to make sure. People get loose with other people's money. I mean, that's just how it is. Yeah,
it happens. It happens.
And what's interesting, the situation you just talked about, it's changed how I approach things too, that specific one, because I make sure that when I do the estate plan, I put in a master asset list where they can write down what they have and what there is specifically so people will know. Because in that situation, the wife didn't know what accounts the husband had. She was going through bank statements trying to figure it out. He passed away. So after that, she had to become his personal representative. So we had to go through probate to get it. And so she could talk to people because his name was on all the accounts. There could be accounts out there that she never knew about. And so I make sure to include an asset list where they can write down and say, I've got this bank account. I've got this. I've got this. I've got this. So just so kids know what there is.
No, that's excellent. Really excellent. We have too many sad stories we could tell. You know, whoops, we should have, because it's never going to happen to us, right? It's never going to happen. I'm 10 feet tall and bulletproof. It's never going to happen. But it happens all the time.
Sure.
And having a plan in place gives you that ability to say, I want this to go here and here and here. What's the process if they don't have it set in place? What's that process look like?
If they don't have any planning done at all?
If they don't have any planning done at all.
Right. So a lot of people think that, and a lot of people come in and their concern is that the state's going to take it all if they don't have anything in place. That's not what happens. You don't have any say over what happens. I mean, the law dictates how things go. It goes according to the intestate laws, which is basically it'll go depending on the situation, but generally to a spouse and then kids down the line, and then it'll go to your parents and then siblings down the line. So the law dictates how things are distributed and divided. But that still causes problems. I mean, I had a case where there was a married couple who, second marriages, they both passed away. One was the daughter of the dad and daughter of the mom, stepsisters, didn't know each other at all. And then mom and dad died. They owned the house together. Mom died first, and then dad died. And so the house passed to dad, and then he died. So it technically passed to his daughter. But mom's daughter had been living there with them, and so she felt she was entitled to the house, but legally she wasn't. That case lasted 2.5 years until ultimately we were able to settle it. It didn't go to, I would have won. I represented dad's daughter who was legally entitled to it. We settled it and they split it 50-50, which they should have done at the beginning, which my client wanted to do. But I mean, that's another story. But yeah, I mean, if you don't have anything, there's not really any say in what you do. I mean, I have clients come in all the time that are like, mom and dad wanted this. And I'm like, sorry, they should have written it down. I mean, at this point, you can't go with what mom and dad said they wanted. So that's the real issue of not having anything written down.
For sure. Too many sad stories. It just takes a little bit of time. It's not that terribly expensive to do a trust for most people. For most people, what type of trust are you going to recommend?
For most people, just a regular revocable trust is fine. That means you can change it. You can make, you know, you can do whatever. And for the people that are creating the trust, it doesn't change anything for them. And I mean, a lot of people come in and they think, you know, if I do a trust, does that mean I don't have any control over my stuff? And no, I mean, you can change it. You can sell your house. You can move. You can redo things. I mean, it doesn't change anything at all for the people putting the stuff in the trust. Generally, unless there's a specific, and as you know, like a Medicaid planning situation or a reason to do an irrevocable trust or some kind of other trust or a special needs trust, something like that, generally a revocable trust is usually sufficient for most people.
Say a little bit more about special needs trusts.
So a special needs trust is a trust that they've specifically made for disabled individuals, because generally the disabled individuals are getting government benefits, Social Security, Medicaid, and they have to keep their countable assets under a certain level, which is actually really low. It's like $2,000-ish. And so what you can do is, if you want to have an inheritance for a disabled child, is you can put it in a special needs trust, which will hold it, and it won't be considered a countable asset, but you can still use it to supplement what the disabled individual is getting. The disabled person's the sole beneficiary of the special needs trust. It needs to be managed by someone else, so you need to set up a trustee would manage it, but it basically supplements whatever the disabled individual is getting as far as government benefits, and it's not counted as an asset, so it doesn't affect any of their government benefits at all.
And if you're doing that type of a trust, you have that circumstance, there's some provision you want to make for guardianship for that handicapped individual as well, because typically the parents are the guardian.
Right. I mean, in your planning, if you have a disabled child, you'd want to indicate who you'd want to be the guardian of the disabled child. Or if you have minor children, you'd want to indicate that, because under the law, there's a priority list of who has priority to be named as the guardian. And if you have a minor child and you parents who the parents dictate they want to be the guardian has top priority. And so you'd want to make sure that that's written down. And a lot of younger people who have minor kids don't think they need to do estate planning because they're like, I don't have assets. I don't have a lot. But for me, I've got a 12-year-old daughter, and the most important thing to me isn't necessarily what happens to my house, it's who would raise my kid if I died tomorrow. And so that's where something at least needs to be written down on who you'd want to be the guardian of your kids. That's a great point.
Perfect. And then when it comes to long-term care planning, that's a whole subject all by itself. But with long-term care planning, if a person needs care, and it gets to the point where we're looking at a skilled nursing facility, and pricing on that's now running in excess of $8,000 per month for that type of care, you can run through assets fairly quickly. So where we see application, and please correct me because that's why we have you here, But where we see application for irrevocable trust is typically in a case where there's a family business, maybe it's a family farm or something similar, where we want continuity of the business. We don't want those assets attached. And it's a cognitive decline that's going to be a long decline. So we have 5 years. Then an irrevocable trust might be a good tool. But if they don't make it 5 years before applying for Medicaid or veterans benefits or what have you, that irrevocable trust is still penetrable, isn't it?
Whatever you move into the irrevocable trust, that starts the look back period of it being considered your asset. So I can't have a family farm move it into an irrevocable trust and then the next day go and say, I don't have any assets, because they'll look back the 5 years. And that's why it's super important to meet with you and do what you do and come up with a plan beforehand, that you're not scrambling at the end and saying, oh no, we got to go into this retirement facility and we're going to blow all our money doing this. Doing an irrevocable trust, there's got to be a lot of foresight, because you got to have that 5-year window to figure out. So it's much, much better to meet with someone like you, Scott, that knows what you're doing, that can say, all right, let's plan for this and let's have a long-term care plan in place. Let's have things going how we want it. So they're not scrambling at the end and trying to figure out what kind of hoops we can jump through to minimize everything.
We had someone come in the office the other day, and kind of an interesting conversation. They said, well, we want to set up a trust to hold our business because we've heard that LLCs don't work anymore. That's not my area of expertise, so.
They do. That's the whole purpose of an LLC, right? An LLC can be penetrated if you do certain things. So, for example, if you commingle assets, you have to keep an LLC separate and make it be its own thing. But for sure, I mean, if you put a business in a regular trust, that gives no protection at all. And so an LLC was always the way to go in my book. And then at that point, it's really just keeping things separate and running it as a separate business. And then for sure, LLCs, they work. They're a good protection. You just got to make sure you don't give an opportunity for someone to be able to penetrate it in any way.
The only thing I could find on Google, because I didn't want to bug you right then, was was that there were some rule changes that the principal parties establishing the LLC had to be identified. It couldn't just be an anonymous setup. There had to be an identifiable individual that was setting it up. But
yeah,
I couldn't see anything otherwise that would cause me to not want to.
Yeah, and I don't even know how you could set it up as anonymous, because when you're doing the articles, you have to at least name a registered agent. You have to name the members. And so if you're trying to be sneaky, maybe, but that's the same as if you're commingling things. I mean, and the thing is, if you think about it, if an attorney's going to try and go for the biggest pot they can, and so they're going to try and get as much into any kind of lawsuit as possible to try and recoup any kind of damages. And so if they can pierce it, they're going to try to pierce it. But, I mean, LLCs have the protection that if you do it correctly, I mean, they work.
The liability is encapsulated in that business entity.
Right, within the LLC, within the box,
perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect. Okay, what else did you have?
I just had one more question. We have a lot of clients that ask how often they have to review their trust.
Well, all the time. It really depends. Generally, the idea is, what I tell clients is that if you have a big life-changing thing, to for sure have it looked at. If you change your mind on anything, have it looked at. And then other than that, maybe every 5 to 10 years, you should just have someone just take a look at it and make sure everything's in place. Old trusts work as good as new trusts. There are some changes that get made that make, for example, with laws that change that make old trusts sometimes, it's not they don't work, it just makes them harder to use, I guess. A lot of times, if you have an older trust that has like an ABC trust within it that's not necessary now, that was necessary back then, it can make just more work to do. That's one thing to look at. But unless there's like a big life-changing event, or you start not liking your kids or something like that, you're probably good.
They're removed.
They're out.
You say the ABC is no longer necessary. Is that because the estate tax threshold's been raised to such a high limit?
Yeah. And that's not saying they're not necessary. It's just a lot of people have, you know, $2 million of assets and they don't need to move stuff around to do it. They can just distribute it. But yeah, and it's exactly why, because the exemption's so high.
Now that's coming back down in 2026. So I think we're going to see a little bit more need there than what we've seen for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
In fact, we've got some clients that definitely should take advantage of that.
Right.
For that very reason.
Right.
They don't always believe me. So if I have you on here on the show as an attorney, you can back me up that with that threshold coming down and their assets continuing to grow, it's very likely that more people will need that estate tax protection by doubling their exemption through an ABC trust.
Right. You're right.
Okay. So hypothetically, a couple sets up a revocable trust. One of the parties passes away. The surviving spouse would have authority to change up whatever he or she wanted to after the fact?
It depends on how the trust is written. So it can if it's written like that. If not, you can write it so they can't. I mean, it really just depends on how the trust is written. And there's reasons for both. There's reasons to allow, because a lot of times people will come in, like for example, with my planning, if I passed away, my wife could do whatever she wanted with it and it's fine. A lot of times people come in and they're nervous about a second marriage situation or, you know, someone coming in and taking advantage of someone. And so we put in protections that they can still make changes, but we put checks and balances in it. They, you know, we add a co-trustee or we add someone else basically has to sign off on doing things, making changes, transferring out stuff. So you can do it either way. Like I said, in my situation, it's not like that. If someone can convince my wife to do it, they've earned it. So she's pretty strong-willed.
Yeah, no, we've seen cases both ways. We have one client and it was not the first marriage. They had no children together. She didn't really bring any significant assets to the marriage. It's mostly his. This was his second marriage. His wife had predeceased him. And he made provisions for his second wife to have a life estate in the home so she didn't have to go find someplace else to live. And that she was put on as beneficiary, you know, so she continued to receive his pension benefits, Social Security benefits. So it worked out well. And his kids got told by him ahead of time, you know, this is how it's going to be. And it's all good. It's been a really good thing to observe. Then we have another client and one spouse passed away. Again, it was a second marriage for both. They had children, but not together. See, he was the first one to go, and his kids made her mad, and she redid everything, and they're completely cut out.
Yep. It happens. I had a client who they set it up where the daughter, when the spouse passed away, the daughter became the trustee specifically to avoid something like that. And then the dad started to deteriorate mentally, and then he met a young lady who this was like her 12th marriage. She was like a professional wife, if you will. And she tried to swoop in. She knew what she was doing. I mean, she tried to swoop in and there was a lot. They were able to protect all the assets and get things figured out. And she didn't take advantage of them. It was pretty wild to the point where her brothers actually wrote letters in support of preventing her from marrying this guy. Because like the last year she'd married a guy down in St. George, taken all his money and then divorced him. Like it was, I didn't think I'd see something like that in my life, but it happens. Stuff happens. And so, yeah, I mean, you can put in protections and different things to try and prevent that.
Yes, please go see Zenek and get your stuff in order. So that doesn't happen to you.
For sure, for sure. We'll put Zenek's information in the show notes, but you're welcome to give people a phone number to call or website to visit.
Sure. The number is 435-535-1708, and the website's www.bishoplg.com.
Excellent. Yep, we give your cards out all the time. It's so worth it, in my opinion, to have things done up correctly. Ounce of prevention and all that. Powers of attorney, I think, are really important once you reach retirement age in particular, because we don't know when we're going to have some life-changing health event like a stroke or some type of a dementia or any of those types of things. Wouldn't it be well to have all your wishes down in writing? People have instructions. They know what's going to happen. And you kind of pull the strings beyond the grave even, you know, if it came to that.
Sure.
So that you don't have your family disintegrate over fighting over dumb stuff. Things I've seen people split up about is just ridiculous. In one case, it was a ceiling fan they were fighting over. Now, I don't really think it was a ceiling fan. I think they were just emotionally distraught over the loss of a parent.
Right.
And they devolved back to their, you know, preschool age selves, and they're fighting over something.
Yeah. Well, that's the weird thing about it is what I notice is there's like a weird combination when a parent passes away. There's grief, there's greed, and then there's the old resentments, like you just said, that pop back up that, you know, back in the day you treated me like this. And so that just like explodes. So there's a weird combination of emotions that happens that people get weird. People do weird things.
And on the other hand, if they have everything laid out, these are my wishes, this is what I'd like to have done, this is how I want things divided, there's been some thought put into it, it's in writing from the parents, and it just goes so smoothly. You know, it can be an okay experience in spite of losing a loved one if they've left things well prepared.
Right.
Yep.
Exactly.
Did you have any more questions?
No. Thank you for a better understanding of estate planning.
Oh, one thing I do want to point out. We have more people come in who, you know, they're getting towards retirement and they've got some cash. You know, they're not paying it on kids anymore and getting debts paid off. So they have some extra cash flow and they go see an attorney. And so they have this shiny new trust binder. And doggone it, we want to use that. And they come in and say, well, the attorney said we should, you know, make the trust the beneficiary of our retirement accounts and things like that. And we then contradict them, saying, no, beneficiary designations actually will trump the trust or will or anything else you have. And with retirement accounts in particular, if you leave that income to the trust, that's going to be taxed at the highest levels. Do you want the IRS to have it or do you want your family to? You know, and of course, they'd rather have their family get it, usually. So beneficiary designations work really great, but for titled assets like real estate, definitely have a trust.
Right. Well, and that's why what I said at the beginning, the idea isn't necessarily to have everything in the trust. It's just to make sure that the stuff you have is going where you want it to go. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's good to work with someone like you that knows what they're doing, where if you want everything to go to your kids, you can name that your kids as the beneficiaries. It'll go to them. Once it gets taxed, it'll be taxed lower than just putting it into a trust. And you can help them take care of that. It's getting from A to B the same. It's just, like you said, more money goes to your family than to the IRS, which I don't think there's anyone that would not want that. That's the benefit of working with someone like you guys that know what you're doing, that can help guide through that, specifically planning for retirement, getting to that point, and then afterwards, how things go and what's the best way to do it. And I always tell clients, if you're working with a financial planner, unless I know the planner and I don't trust them, to just trust what you have to say, because you're the one managing the money. You know what's going on. With you, Scott, I know you know what you're doing. And so if you say to put the kids as a beneficiary and that's better to do, it makes more sense. And why not pay taxes?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Right?
Yeah,
that's right?
That's what I'm thinking. All right. Well, Zenick, thanks so much. We're so glad to have you as a resource. And we appreciate you taking the time today to help give those who may have a chance to listen to this good advice and get them on a good path and explain why. If anybody is listening to this and you find value in it, we'd love it if you'd share it with your friends. Just get the word out. The more education, the more power. We'll have things done upright. Thanks again, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you found this information useful, please share it. If there is something you hear that raises a question, you can sign up for our free consultation as well as sign up for our free newsletter. Visit askscottnelson.com to sign up. Thanks for listening. Remember, if you plan well, you can retire happy.
The information provided is for educational purposes only and is not intended as investment advice for anyone. All information discussed is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. The views presented today are those of SLN Financial Incorporated and do not necessarily represent the views of Alpha Star Capital Management, LLC. The opinions expressed are subject to change without notice and do not constitute financial, legal, or tax advice. Please consult your financial professional before executing any financial strategy. Investment advisory and financial planning services are offered through Alpha Star Capital Management, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Alpha Star and SLN Financial Incorporated are independent entities.